Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Matt Sullivan. I represent the defendant and appellant in this case, Dr. John Natale. This case has a unique set of facts and circumstances that, taken together, show that what transpired below was truly unfair and has led to the incarceration of a surgeon who has spent his life helping people for something that is not a crime under Section 1035. That is, alleged false statements that have nothing at all to do with Medicare or an insurance plan. Obviously, I want to focus on whatever is most helpful to the Court, but what I propose to do is begin by talking briefly about the facts and circumstances about the case. Then I want to move on to the jury instructions and also address the waiver issue raised by the government in their papers. And then I want to close by talking about the demonstrative exhibit that was sent back to the jury room over Dr. Natale's objection. Three items here really combined to undermine the verdict, and taken together they show that the verdict rests upon alleged false statements that the jury did not believe beyond a reasonable doubt to be related to Medicare. So the first, there was a wide body of evidence before the trial court put on by the government relating to the issue of whether Dr. Natale installed a bifurcation graft or a tube graft on his patients. The problem with that is that that doesn't relate to Medicare in any way. The government concedes, never alleged, that Dr. Natale billed Medicare any more money for installing a bifurcation graft as versus a tube graft. So that issue has nothing to do with Medicare at all. Nonetheless, slightly more than half of the false statements alleged in the charging instrument have to do with this bifurcation graft versus tube graft issue. And contrary to the government's brief that barely mentions this issue, somewhere on the order of half of the evidence that was put on in trial related to this bifurcation graft versus tube graft issue. And then over Dr. Natale's objection, an exhibit was sent back to the jury room. That exhibit focused the jury, misdirected the jury to this particular issue. And you probably looked at it already, but the exhibit is on page 58 and 59 of the appendix. I think it really has to be seen to be appreciated. It shows the actual operation is a very small tube graft, and then it says that the operation described in the operative report is a bifurcation graft that's much bigger and just is strikingly different visually, and that's the only demonstrative exhibit the jury had in the jury room, so it made it look as if this is what the case is about.
I'm really more interested in the legal issue here. I don't pretend to understand the medical aspects of this case, but in your argument that you're making now about the factual basis for the false statements claims really goes to the issue of harm. And whether the instructional error that's argued here is prejudicial. I know you're also making a sufficiency of the evidence argument as well, but I think the main event on this appeal has to do with these jury instructions and whether they correctly stated the law, and that in turn depends upon a question of statutory interpretation with respect to this crime, 18 U.S. Code Section 1035, the false statements crime. And
yeah, that's right.
Its elements. And there's a threshold question of waiver here because there was no objection made to the instructions. So maybe you could address that.
Okay. I was addressing that in part because it plays into the there with the jury instructions, because obviously if you have statements before the jury that don't have to do with Medicare, it becomes very important whether
right,
the jury
to the
instructions
heart.
Require
right.
it to tie the false statements to Medicare. But let's talk about the waiver issue. So waivers versus forfeiture, as the court knows, occurs where a defendant chooses as a matter of strategy, not to present an argument. And this is also a facts and circumstances specific analysis. This court has said that over and over again. So whether a decision to forego an argument is a strategy decision is something that the court determines based on the particular facts and circumstances of each case. The court assumes forfeiture where the government fails to proffer a strategic justification for a defendant's decision to bypass an argument. And here the government has offered no possible strategic justification for failing to object to the jury instructions. And in particular, they concede, at least the way I read the brief, they concede two errors in the jury instructions, that the jury instructions should have required the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the false statements were in a matter involving Medicare, or in a matter involving an insurance plan, and that Medicare is a relevant insurance plan here, and that the false statements were material to Medicare, whereas the jury instructions simply said material to any person or entity. They proffered no strategic reason why a defendant would want to do that. I can't think of a reason why a defendant would prefer a jury instruction that said material to any person or entity as opposed to material to Medicare. And that's especially true in this case, given that evidence that I just described that was before the jury, because this was a really critical matter in this case. So it really can't have been a strategy decision. It doesn't make sense that it would have been a strategy decision. So there was no waiver for that reason, because it was no
strategy. Our case law is pretty clear on waiver, though, isn't it, when we have an affirmative statement by counsel?
I don't think so. There are a series of cases on this, and most of those cases deal with a situation where counsel has – there's been a discussion about that issue below. There are two Griffin cases, and they're both of the same nature. But the 96 Griffin case, for example, you know, the defense counsel brought up that the jury instruction was wrong because of a Supreme Court case. The judge went back and rewrote it. There was some more discussion about it, and then finally the counsel said, okay, I'm not objecting. So that's different. He was aware of what the issue was. That issue was discussed below. There was a knowing decision to waive that argument. The exception is the, and I'm going to say this wrong, the Anna Fawashi case. In that case was a pro se appeal. And in that case, the issue was a conscious avoidance instruction. And what the court has said in other cases addressing waiver is that you look at whether there's a plausible strategy justification and for not objecting to that. And
other circuits have taken a different route. I agree with that, Mr. Sullivan. But
I think this circuit has taken that route in cases dealing with other things. The Jaime case is an example. So this circuit has taken that route that it has to be a strategy decision. In other contexts, I just don't think they've addressed it specifically in the jury instruction context, because the jury instructions that have been presented to the court could plausibly have been strategy decisions. So any counsel knows what a conscious avoidance instruction is, and it may be, and I recognize this is a little bit circular, but it may be that it was just such a bad argument that it made sense. It was a strategy decision not to bring it up in the first place. So there's certainly no cases addressing the issue in the Seventh Circuit saying that regardless of whether it's a strategy decision, jury instructions can't be appealed. I don't read those cases as saying that. They just never really address that issue, and the cases just are not factually similar to this case at all, in that there are instances where there have been discussion about this issue below, or instances where, you know, it was something that counsel clearly understood below. And here I don't think that's the case. I think it's somewhat similar to the Perez case in the Ninth Circuit, although that was actually an invited error case where the defendant had proposed a jury instruction. But there, both sides just kind of missed it. And here the government proposed the jury instructions, and they're conceding on appeal that there were at least two very significant mistakes in the jury instructions. So I can't see here where that would have been a strategy decision. It seems to me that they just missed the issue. And under Alano, the Supreme Court case, where it's not a strategy decision, where it's not a knowing waiver, then there's no waiver. And remember that waiver is strictly construed against the government, right? So if there's any question the court errs on the side of forfeiture and not waiver. Finally, even if the court were to find that it was that this issue was waived, and it should not because it wasn't a strategy decision, that doesn't mean that in determining the prejudice from the exhibit that went back to the jury, the court can't consider what the jury instructions said. So you don't have to pretend like the jury instructions said something they didn't say when you're considering the waiver, or I'm sorry, when you're considering the prejudice from this demonstrative exhibit going back to the jury room. So
you're in your rebuttal time, but go ahead.
Just very quickly, the error was plain. The government doesn't dispute it. And I think it's important to understand in terms of the prejudice that there's no conflict in the verdict here. The verdict is only explainable if the government, if the jury did not believe that these false statements related to Medicare. It acquitted Dr. Natale of the three counts where the jury instructions asked it to decide whether there was a connection between the false statements and Medicare. The only connection that the government ever proposed was this fraud allegation. The jury didn't believe it. The two counts that he was convicted of, the jury instructions were very different, and they only make sense if they're based on this bifurcation graft versus tube graft issue. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Bacciu?
May it please the Court. Obviously, I understand the Court's interest here is on the waiver issue, so I'll address the instructional issue first. There was a clear waiver in this case, and I think it's important to look at the cases this Court has already decided in the waiver context to understand, in fact, that it's undisputable that there, in fact, was a waiver. We start with the Aneth Washe case, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right as well. But in that case, the defense attorney said, with regard to the instructions, I'm in agreement with those. And then later, when the Court noted that the instructions were given without objection, the defense attorney said, that's correct. Now, the defendant on appeal argued that these affirmations did not rise to the level of an intentional relinquishment of a known right because, essentially, that wasn't satisfactory. But this Court said that if that argument was accepted, it would create almost an insurmountable standard to proving waiver, and that this argument was not persuasive. This was a very well-reasoned decision that was followed again by this Court in the Gonzalez case. And in that case, the statement was that there was no objection. And again, the Court enforced the waiver in that case. And in that case, the jury was not presented with definitions for what a prohibited drug was and what possession was, not a definition given to the jury at all. Even more recently, in the O'Connor case, a statement of no objection to a joint venture instruction was sufficient to create a waiver. So this Court, there was talk about, well, what about strategic purpose? This Court, in its waiver cases, as it relates specifically to jury instructions, has not inquired into the strategic purpose of the waiver. And there's perhaps two reasons for that. One is, when you're looking at a specific instruction, and in this case, we had a judge that didn't just come out on the bench and say, does anybody want to raise an issue with regard to the jury instructions? That's not how this worked. We had a jury instruction conference. We sat down, and the judge went through the instructions one by one by one and asked counsel, was there a particular objection, any problem with that instruction? And when there was a problem with an instruction, defense counsel noted that objection. And there were at least one, perhaps two, instructions proposed by the government that were not given because of the objection interposed by counsel. So in this situation, counsel's attention was specifically focused on the instructions in question, and counsel indicated that they had no objection to the instructions that were given. So under this case, the court's law, as decided in the cases I've mentioned, the waiver is clear. Counsel suggests this court should follow the Perez case from the Ninth Circuit. That was an en banc decision. The one thing I would point out about that case is that there were approximately five judges on that en banc panel who did not join the entire opinion. And when they said they were not joining the entire opinion, they pointed to this court's case law in the older Griffin case as stating the correct method of proceeding with regards to waiver as it relates to jury instructions.
What do the rules say?
Well, Rule 30 actually talks about the fact that if an instruction is not objected to, that review is for plain error. But what we have here, Judge, is not just merely a failure to object to instruction. So, for example, if we go back to the example I gave before, if we had a situation where the court had come out and said, is there anything we need to take up with regard to the jury instructions, and nothing had been said, what we had here was an affirmative statement by counsel saying, with regard to a specific instruction, that they had no objection. That's a little different than just a failure to object in general. And so when we look at the other cases where this court has actually made some sort of inquiry into strategic purpose, it's usually a situation where the objection is of a general nature. For example, with regards to a pre-sentence investigation report, any objection to the total guidelines calculation in this case. In that type of situation, this court has been more apt to actually look for the strategic purpose behind the failure to object to a particular guideline calculation that was not specifically addressed.
Do the rules take note of those distinctions?
Judge, I think the rule by saying that a failure to object is making, my reading of the rule is that when it says failure to object, what it's saying is that there is no real objection or anything on the record at all that the court can point to. But in this case, when counsel was asked, is there any problem with the instruction, counsel said no. And let me also add in regards to this issue that there was a strategic purpose here, and we do not concede that there was not a strategic purpose behind this waiver. If you look at page 41 of our brief, we talk about this issue later on when we talk to those issues that relate to whether or not there was any impairment of the defendant's substantial rights. But look at this case. Was this case about whether or not this case involved a health care benefit program?
No, if the charges in counts 4 and 5, I think the ones that he was convicted on, if I have the count numbers correct, had to do with false statements in the operative report. So there was no connection to Medicare. So I failed to see any logical, strategic reason why the error in the jury instructions would have been waived,
Judge,
as an affirmative matter, as opposed to merely forfeited, overlooked.
I would disagree with that, because if you look at the record, we know what strategy counsel employed in this case. His strategy wasn't to argue, is this a matter involving a health care benefit plan? It's like, for example, Judge, in cases where we have a felon in possession case.
As to the first three counts, which clearly involved misstatements on Medicaid forms or Medicare forms, right, in his billing.
Well, Judge,
the claims having to do with the operative reports, the only ones that he was convicted of.
But let me clarify as to what what was charged in those first three counts. What was charged in those first three counts was not only the false statements made on the Medicare claim forms, but also the false statements that were made in the operative reports as well. In fact, the executions charged in the first two counts were the false statements made in the very operative reports the jury convicted on. So it's not correct to say that the first three counts were related just to the Medicare claim. That's not correct at all. The fact is, counsel employed a strategy at trial that was not, you know, is this a matter involving health care benefit program? Can you imagine what type of reaction the jury would have to that type of strategy? We had undisputed evidence from Kelly Hartung saying that the defendant had been paid with regards to claims he had submitted for surgeries performed on Ms. Mariner and Ms. Gordon. And then we have these reports that in our presentation of the case to the jury, we indicated that they were made with the purpose of actually supporting the false Medicare claims. So it wasn't the strategy of the defense to argue that. The strategy of the defense in this case.
But the jury didn't have to find that on counts 4 and 5 under these instructions. Even though that may have been your theory of the case, the instructions were legally wrong. I think you've conceded that, or maybe you haven't.
Well, Judge, our position is that the instructions or the law does require that it be a matter involving a health care benefit program. Our view
is
that
the intent element be keyed to that. In other words, the intent.
Well, no,
Medicare.
No, absolutely not, Judge. There is no element in with regards to 1035 regarding intent to deceive. That is completely not the case. In fact, this court has decided in relation to 1001, a very similar false statement statute, that there is, or at least has suggested in the Rasnum case, that there is no element of the offense that relates to intent to deceive. This court followed the Supreme Court's case in Yermayan in saying that we don't believe that there is such an element with respect to 1001 in deciding a case relating to another false statement statute.
Well, right, but we have to take the law as it existed at the time that this statute was enacted, and at that time the legal consensus was that this, the 101 crime, this is programmatic fraud particular to healthcare programs, and 1001 is agency fraud in general, and the law at that time was that the fraudulent misrepresentation had to be directed at something that was material to the program, right, or to the agency, I should say.
Well, Judge, the question is what law are you looking at? And as I understand this Court's cases on plain error review, it's not the law in another circuit that the Court looks to. It looks to the law in this circuit.
I think you're misunderstanding my point. We have to decide now what this statute means, what its elements are, and whether the intent element of this statute has to be keyed in some way to the health care benefits program or plan. And we do that by reference to the legal backdrop against which Congress enacted the statute.
Well,
not what our case law since then has said, but what the legal backdrop at the time was. And as I understand the interpretation of the parallel statute, 1001, is that it was pretty uniformly understood to require that nexus.
Well, I would make two points. First, the Supreme Court, and I don't know the exact date of the Urmia decision. I think it may have preceded the enactment of the statute, but I'm not sure. But I would say two things. One, the Supreme Court has never adopted the view that the false statement statutes, for example, 1001 and 1035, require intent to deceive. The Urmia set case, in fact, suggests that there is no intent to deceive.
No, but they have to be material. Material to the misrepresentation has to be material to the program.
Okay, so then we would agree that there has to be a materiality instruction given. One materiality instruction was given in this case. What's important to note too,
but material though, to what? All this instruction said was material to a person, which
right.
is like.
But in the context, Fair enough, Judge. But in the context of this case, I'd have two responses to that. One, the jury was given a willfulness instruction that there had to be an intent to actually do something that was prohibited by law. The only evidence the jury got in relation to that point was that the defendant knew and was on notice that it was prohibited by law to supply false information in relation to a claim that had been filed. There was a government exhibit EDI agreement which specified that the defendant had to keep his medical records for 6 years and 3 months, and that the government had the right to audit those records to confirm any claim that was filed. That would be point number one. Point number two would be that when we actually presented this case to the jury in argument, we actually addressed element by element with respect to counts 4 and 5 what the jury had to find. We had a PowerPoint presentation. It's actually part of the record on appeal in this case. If you look at PowerPoint slide 155 in our closing presentation, it specifies element, materiality. And then when we actually talk about that element, we actually say in bullet points, it had effect of influencing the action of Medicare or was capable of or had the potential to do so. And underneath that first bullet point, we say Medicare does not actually need to rely on statement potential is enough.
Right. Why didn't you put that in the instructions?
Judge,
that's the law.
Well, Judge, I think one of the potential issues here is that that was shorthand because in terms of an entity, Medicare is not an entity. It's actually Wisconsin Physician Services, which is the contractor that actually performs the review in this case. In a generic kind of loose colloquial sense, it is Medicare, and that's why we actually used that reference in our PowerPoint presentation. So there was no mistake that the government's theory in this case was that this was a false statement that was made for the purpose of influencing Medicare, and to suggest otherwise, it just ain't so.
Right. You're not going to use these instructions again, are you?
No, Judge. Well, obviously they were not the ideal instructions, and the clarity that the counsel's pointed out to.
Mr. Rogers, didn't the instruction at base offer a lower threshold for conviction?
No, Judge, because the point I've been trying to make is that with regards to this matter involving health care benefit program, that wasn't where the dog was in this fight. The fight was whether or not the statements were made knowingly. So with regards to the closing argument of defense counsel, when he actually talked about the operative reports, look at page 1272 of the record, his focus was on the fact that this defendant didn't make these false statements knowingly. He was really busy, he had a lot of other patients to see, etc. Now, our response to that was, well, these false statements actually started on the very day of the operation, during the operation itself. You had a situation where the defendant was actually saying, in the course of the operation, to somebody in the operating room, I'm actually doing a surgery involving the renal arteries, and a surgery involving the iliac arteries. And then that same false statement is repeated over and over and over again in every single record that's produced. Their defense was these statements were not knowing and they were not willful. It wasn't that I didn't get paid by Medicare in relation to the surgeries I performed on Ruby Gordon and Mary Pat Mariner. And the other thing is, one of the final elements in this case, Judge, was that the fourth element, that this was done in connection with payment of benefits for health provision
but
of health care benefits.
More than that, the instruction said it, not just in connection with payment of benefits, but also with in connection with the rendering of services,
well,
which can mean anything that's said by a doctor or to a doctor. And that's what the statute authorizes, I think, properly interpreted.
But the statute, Judge, with regards to the definition of a health care benefit program, uses the exact same phraseology, the provision of a medical benefit item or service that's provided.
Right, but the government doesn't take the position that it means any false statement in connection with health care services in general.
It means any false statement that's rendered in connection with the payment of health care benefits, items, or services, to the extent
by a plan affecting interstate commerce.
Correct. And in this case, it was undisputed that the Medicare plan affects interstate commerce. Kelly Hartung's testimony was undisputed. She was never crossed on the fact that the defendant had actually supplied services to these two patients. She was never crossed on the fact that Medicare is a multi-billion-dollar program. If this case went back, is it plausible to say that defense counsel's argument would have been that the matter didn't involve a health care benefit program? It's not.
Right. No, I understand that. And I understand your sufficiency of the evidence argument, but I'm talking about what's the proper construction of the statute. And the government doesn't contend that it authorizes prosecution of any false statement made in connection with the rendition of any health care services made to or by any health care professional, regardless of whether it's connected with payment.
It has to be with regards to a health care benefit plan that affects commerce. The jurisdictional hook here, obviously, is the interstate commerce power that Congress has and the need to prevent both. The interesting thing about the statute is it prohibits false statements in relation to both public and private plans.
Right.
The hook, though, being that there's a relationship to commerce.
Right, but the jury wasn't instructed on that with respect to counts 4 and 5.
Correct, but the jury was not instructed on that type of material in the Griggs case, which we cite in our brief, and the court said that, let alone being plain error, was not even harmless error because nobody contested it. Similarly, in the Maloney case, in that situation, we also have a situation where there was no instruction relating to the need to find dependency of an official proceeding. The court said that since the jury found another fact, which is that there had been obstruction, that it necessarily found that fact. So in cases where even harmless error review is undertaken, the error is not sufficient to overturn the conviction. And for that reason, we'd ask the court to affirm the convictions in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Lajew. Mr. Sullivan.
Again, the error was hugely prejudicial in this case and affected the verdict. And part of the jury had before it in the jury room a document that pointed it towards this exact issue, this bifurcation graft versus tube graft issue. And it seems silly to suggest that the strategy of counsel below was not to argue that these statements didn't relate to Medicare. If they related to Medicare, the government's argument that they related to Medicare was that he committed fraud. He was arguing they didn't relate to Medicare. He didn't commit fraud. They were just mistakes. So it's not contrary to the strategy below. That doesn't make any sense. With respect to waiver, counsel is arguing for a rigid rule, a rule that anytime somebody says no objection, that's the end of it. This court has said in the U.S. versus Anderson case, there is no rigid rule for finding waiver and acquiescence. The court evaluates each omission individually. So what he's arguing is contrary to that. Also, it's important to understand that this is a situation where they went through every single jury instruction and said, any objection, no, any objection, no, any objection, no. And
that hurts you.
It does, but as Your Honor points out, the rule is that when a defendant fails to object to jury instructions, he has forfeited the right to assign
those. Is there a difference between failure to object and saying no objection?
I think it depends on the facts and circumstances. And I'm not saying it's something the court shouldn't consider.
Don't you see a distinction between saying no objection and not objecting?
Yeah, I do see a distinction between that. I do see a distinction between that.
I lost my marbles.
There is a difference between that, and I think there's also a difference between the facts and circumstances of this case.
You don't anticipate that the trial judge should wrestle with him when he says no objection. Say, you know, you're sure you have no objection? Come on now, you must have an objection.
It's just something that wasn't addressed, right? So, it wasn't addressed below. It should have been addressed below. I don't know why it wasn't addressed below. But clearly there was an error, and I think clearly it affected the verdict under these circumstances. Because when you look at the verdict, it only makes sense if the conviction is based on the alleged false statements about this bifurcation graft issue that everybody agrees had nothing to do with Medicare. I see my time has expired. So, thank you, Your Honor.
Government counsel, the case is taken under advisement.